Accession number 4488, Reel 4.
Brigadier O'Flynn, Reel 4. Did you have any special training to cope with accidents in an armoured car?
I don't know if it was official training, but as a result of learning with one's crews in those days, one was told there were certain things one ought to do if one had an accident and how to mitigate the effects of the accident. And I remember absorbing that. But my armoured car driving in those days was limited because naturally that with a member of a crew of four, the officer wasn't allowed to hog the driving. And so one came in occasionally when the others were prepared to let him come in. But I did learn one very useful lesson, and I realised I learnt that lesson by absorption rather than specific instruction. I had an accident to my own car last year. When driving along the Farnham bypass, just beyond Farnham, with my wife to see a sister in hospital, some very elderly gentleman, older than I am, was unkind enough to drive out of a side turning straight into the Farnham bypass road and hit me on my near side rear wheel. It was a somewhat of a shock to find one's car hit from behind, and my immediate action was the car started to swing, and I automatically reverted to what I had learnt in those armoured car days, was to relax my body, drive my elbows into my hips, hold the wheel tight so that it couldn't turn left or right, put my head forward, right forward, and as soon as I could, bring the car to a halt facing in a straight line, having slipped out the clutch, and as soon as the car stopped, apply the handbrake firmly, switch off the engine, and look at your watch. And strangely enough, I did all that automatically into looking at the watch. Because when I told the policeman, a very nice policeman who came to recover me later, I said, he said, at the time, sir, you were the accident, I said, well, I can tell you precisely, it was at 2:15. Because that's what my watch showed, and I looked at the watch, because I think I rang you up. He said, you did, sir. He said, we got your message at 2:17.
And did you ever have an accident with the armoured car in Egypt?
No.
When did you leave Alexandria?
Well, towards the end of September, the 12th Lancers were due to have completed their takeover of armoured cars in Egypt by the end of September, and about the middle of September, the detachment of 12th Lancers due to take over from us arrived. Captain Fisher, who subsequently became Major Fisher, was in charge of that troop, and he was accompanied by, I think, Lieutenant Dozy Willis, who subsequently became a very great friend of mine in the Transjordan Frontier Force. We handed over our cars and our equipment to this detachment. Some of us went by road, wheel transport to Cairo. The rest of us followed in the train. I took over the train detachment, and we rejoined the 3rd Armoured Car Company, who were then stationed in the main barracks, Abbasir, in which they had a wing of the barracks occupied by the 13th, 18th Queen's Hussars.
Did all the men who served with you in Alexandria go to Cairo?
Yes, the whole troop went up as a troop. And when we went up, we still retained our name as number one section. But unfortunately, there was no equipment for us.
No armoured cars, is that?
No armoured cars, no tanks, not anything. And so what happened was, the other two sections, which had been handed over their cars to the 12th Lancers about a year before and had since been equipped with the standard medium tank of that time, were well away in their tank training, but we had nothing at all to do. and owing to the usual shortage of funds in Great Britain and the cutting of the army estimates, we were told we were unlikely to have any tanks to replace our armoured cars before late in 1931. And accordingly, the soldiers, many of the soldiers were given jobs on regiment, on squadron transport. But it was a very depressing time for me as an officer, because I had no responsibilities and no jobs to do other than doing barrack inspections and doing all the odd jobs about the place, because I was the latest joint second lieutenant and therefore at the end of the queue for any jobs. So I found myself doing all sorts of things. And I think it was about 2 months later that the High Commissioner, Sir Percy Lorraine, who at that time had about 8 Royal Tank Corps personnel attached to his legation to drive his staff cars and act as outriders, thought he needed some officer to come and inspect his troops at least every 2 weeks to make quite certain that they were as smart as they ought to be and sort out any problems for them. So I then found myself with the task of going down to the embassy or twice a week, I think it was Tuesdays and Thursdays, to inspect the soldiers or hear what problems they had and meet the embassy staff, with whom I became quite friendly. But it was not a job which required much intellect, but just a presence. And other odd jobs came my way. I can't remember what they were. I know during that period I worked and passed my promotion exam from sergeant to captain. It was a football season, and I became highly involved with a local rugby team, which at that time had 2 at one time army players, and between us we managed to get quite a lot of interest in the other regiments in Cairo. We formed a regimental football league, and also I was a runner, so I endeavoured to encourage 3 company and the other company, 5 company, which had come to Cairo the year before to dispose of its armoured cars to the 12th Lancers and await re-equipment with tanks in preparation to forming another tank battalion in Egypt. And therefore my time was just killing time, as it were.
Where did you live in Cairo?
The 3rd Armoured Car Company shared a mess in a place well known called Haking House, which also housed the Royal Signals in Cairo and the 2nd Field Engineer Regiment. It was a wonderful mess. It was a blend of officers from 3 different corps. It was a very, very happy mess and a very well organized mess. Unlike Egypt, we had a proper mess staff to run the mess, a mess sergeant in charge, I think 2 soldier waiters, and 6 or so Egyptians. Batman out there was on the same scale as in Alexandria. Captains and above had their own servant, Egyptian, and subalterns and shared. Accommodation was tight, and throughout my time in Cairo, I shared a room, very nice room with a veranda, with a second lieutenant, Garnet Eccles, whom I had known since I first joined the Corps, and for whom I eventually stood as best man at his wedding, and sad to recall that he died earlier this year.
What were the barracks for the men like?
Very good. They were solidly built brick barracks behind brick walls. I think they must have been built for the Turkish army, which was of course in Egypt before the war, but they were very old, very solid, but very well maintained, and no one could get in because one had to go through a large wooden gate, a above which were the second and third stories, and they were very good accommodation in those barracks. They were had been brought up to date and were very well maintained.
Did you have to inspect the barracks as in Alexandria?
Well, every troop officer has his periodical task of inspecting barrack rooms and things like that, because the same problems arose as in Alexandria. Friday was debugging and de-lysing days, and of course there were more problems in Cairo, because of course that also applied to the stores in which blankets and bedding and that stuff was kept. So there always had to be a fatigue party on to turn out them, these things. But otherwise, I think life in Cairo was more restricted as far as the soldiers were concerned, because it was a garrison town, more military police and all the rest of it, whereas in Alexandria we'd merely been more or less been our own bosses, and provided we behaved ourselves, nothing went wrong.
Were there certain areas of Cairo that were out of bounds to soldiers?
A large amount of Cairo was out of bounds. I cannot remember all the areas, but I know we were not allowed to drive off the main roads or go off the main roads. And when we drove down to Cairo, going past the station, I remember there was an area called Boulak, which was out of bounds to all Europeans, quite rightly so, because I think you might have got your throat slit had you been inside. One's always hearing stories of this. And there was a red light district around the Muski.
What was the Muski?
The Muski was a big bazaar in Cairo, which is a must for all tourists. It has the most wonderful collection of shops selling every imaginable thing. It had the most wonderful jeweler shops, perfume shops, clothes shops, everything. It's one of the highlights of Cairo, even today, where I was 4 years ago, showing my wife round the delights of Cairo.
What other sort of recreations were there for the men in Cairo?
Again, there was a lot of sport. Everything was well organized. There was hockey. Hockey went on all the year. Cricket, most of the year. Rugby, soccer, athletics. There were some very good Egyptian football teams, which had quite a following amongst the soldiers and the civilians. I think, in many ways, the soldiers enjoyed Cairo. It was a very happy existence. There was a lot of entertainment there for them. Plenty of cafes, plenty of nightlife. Perhaps a little too much nightlife, but at any rate, everybody enjoyed himself out there.
And for yourself, what sort of social life was there?
Social life was tremendous. I think it was a bit too much. But Cairo, in those days, was a large garrison town. We actually had in Cairo an infantry brigade of 3 battalions, a cavalry brigade of 3 regiments. Just outside Cairo, there were in what were called 3 regiments of artillery, horse, field, and light, plus RASC. And in addition to that, there were an enormous number of British civilians, all very wealthy, all very generous with their entertainment. And for a young officer, I found life a little too much, because as a keen soldier, I found I got rather bored in Cairo. There was not much for me to do. I had the most exciting time in Alexandria, and this was rather depressing. I spent a lot of sport down there. We had a very good rugby team in Cairo. In fact, 1 year that we played the West Yorkshire Regiments in the final and just lost to them. We also, Harding Newman, whom I've mentioned before, and myself, managed to build up a very strong athletics team, and a team which, carrying out the traditions of the Third Tanks at home, won for 2 years in Egypt the Egyptian championships. And I, fortunately, was the Egyptian quarter-mile champion for 2 years running, and was known by many of my friends as that WOG champion. Well, that old again, it's a light-hearted touch, perhaps.
Did you meet many Egyptians in Cairo?
Quite a number in Cairo, socially. There was a certain distance kept most of them, we were, shall we say, an occupying army, as we were. There was no what I would call hostility to us individually, but we naturally tended to socialise amongst our own kind, firstly amongst our own regiments and our corps, and then amongst the other officers and the messes near to us, and with a large number of civilians. It was a very social place, because as a young officer you could expect to be dined out 4 nights a week.
What was your pay like in Cairo?
Very poor. My pay when I went to Cairo was, the second lieutenant was 10 and 4 pence a day. But then early in 1931, when the government had these cuts, it was reduced, I think, to 9 and 6 pence. And I think when I got my second pip, it went up to 11 and 6 pence. In addition to that, one had certain allowances, but they were not as generous as the allowances I had been used to in Alexandria when living in that house by the sea.
Why were they less in Cairo, the allowances?
Because I, as an individual, was no longer getting heat, light, fuel, all those allowances. I was living in the mess. The mess was very well run. It was a very comfortable mess, very comfortable mess. In those days, in addition to one's rations, we all had to pay 3 and 6 pence a day extra messing for living in the mess. Well, this was customary in those days. All officers paid messing expenses. Some of the cavalry regiments out there, I think, were paying up to 5 shillings a day, but then we hadn't the money that they had.
Did you go into the barracks every day?
Oh, yes, of course. The mess was 100 yards from the barracks. The work was as before. The first prayer was 8 o'clock every morning, and we worked until noon, doing such jobs as we had to do. Mine were rather boring, others were more exciting. After lunch, one normally played games. There were very excellent sporting facilities there. Bang alongside the main barracks was the Slade Ground, which was the hockey and soccer ground in the winter, and the main cricket ground in the summer. And in the spring and summer was also the athletics track. And there were several other football fields in Cairo. I can't remember the names now. There were certainly two grounds in which I used to play rugger. I say the sporting facilities there was equivalent to those the army used to have at Aldershot, which was superb. In fact, in those days, the army, apart from being soldiers, sporting requirements or sporting achievements was required as almost an essential. Because this is how regiments maintain their morale and encourage recruits by having a reputation for being good athletes, good footballers, good cricketers, whatever you know. And it's interesting to recall that in those days, except association football, one usually found army players in all the best county sides. Several played rugby for England. A number played rugby and hockey for Ireland, and quite a number of my contemporaries ran for England.
About your military duties in Cairo, were you ever told what they would be?
Well, I don't quite know what the question told them. When you're a junior officer, you know what your duties are because you have certain responsibilities to the men around you. In addition to that, you carry out at various times of the year certain training tasks and training responsibilities. So in that sense, one's duties were quite clear-cut. But the problem I found was that as a section of about 35 chaps with no real actual responsibilities to carry out until such time as our equipment arrived, it was very, very difficult. So therefore, one was constantly thinking with my section officer, still Guy Thompson, although at that time we'd gone down one officer because we had no need for him. We were very hard pressed, but we kept going. We did map training exercises, weapon training exercises. We attached ourselves for time to the other sections so we could learn crew duties and crew functions, but we were kept busy all the time. I think the soldiers were active, but I, as a subaltern, has no mental responsibilities to. This, I think, was a big trouble. And this went on, I suppose, until April 1932.
Can you describe a map training exercise?
Well, you have a map, and you have some country, and you try to recognize the various objects on the ground and point them out on the map. It's part of the basic training of a soldier.
What would the country be like that you were exercising in?
Well, there, we were exercising just outside Cairo. It's called the Makatam Hills. It's a hill range in the desert. But, I mean, there are all sorts of things like it. Road exercises. I can't remember all specific details, but it kept the training going and that. But, as I say, it was difficult to pinpoint all those things, but it wasn't until after the athletic sports in 1931 it was decided I should go home to England to do my instructor's gunnery course. When I duly reported back in Cairo, it was confirmed by my CO at the time. The latest information was that the new battalion would be formed about February or March next year, and I would present, I was to be his adjutant.
What did that involve, being the adjutant at that time?
Well, it's very hard to remember, but an adjutant in those days was an adjutant. He really ran the regiment under the direction of the commanding officer. He was responsible for the discipline, the drill, and the administration of the adjutant. You didn't have bodies like assistant adjutants and paymasters and all those people running around. It was a very important task. And in view of that, he told me, I'd also be nominated as from January to go off and be the camp adjutant of the brigade camps, which formed each year just after Christmas at near the Giza pyramids. These camps were occupied for three weeks at a time. It's the same site and same tents were occupied for 3 weeks at a time by, first of all, the Cairo Infantry Brigade, and when they departed, as far as I remember, the Canal Brigade came up from Oesca, and lastly, the Cavalry Brigade from Cairo went to these camps and carried out their formation training. And at the end of the 3rd Brigade training, then a large exercise to embrace the 3 brigades in Cairo was carried out.
Did you go on one of these exercises?
During the time I was with the Cairo Brigade, the Canal Brigade was there, I went on two other exercises with acting as a staff captain.
When was this?
This was, I suppose there was a 2nd Brigade there. It must have been February.
Of which year?
February or March 32, the same time I was at the camp. And there, you see, I worked with him, and it gave me an added interest. I'd never functioned with a brigade headquarters before, and I learned what the duties of the various staff officers were, and it was a very interesting exercise. And then after that, the cavalry brigade came to the camp, and at the end of that camp, it shut down, we packed up, and I returned to Cairo.
Can you describe the sort of thing you did on the exercise?
Well, I was one of the junior staff officers under Brigade Major, sort of keeping up the intelligence map and going out with him on one of his reconnaissances and just seeing what went on.
And later in that year you went on the gunnery course?
Yes, after at the end of April 1932, I was sent home an instructor's gunnery course at the Royal Tank Corps Gunnery Schools at Lulworth. On completion of the gunnery course, I then had a month's leave with my family at home and then sailed for Egypt from Southampton on a packet passage, it was called in those days, to Alexandria arriving back there about 14 days later. And having reported to the Costanian, who confirmed that the battalion was still about to form next year, and that I should get ready, thinking about it. But a fortnight later, he sent for me again and asked me what I'd been doing while at home, because he'd received instructions I had to proceed to the Transjordan Frontier Force forthwith. I explained to him, and I was very sorry, but this was unknown to me. When I had seen this chap at the Colonial Office, I was told I had no hope of going to the Colonial Forces for at least 2 years. And so I did not say I could go to the Transjordan Front. At any rate, Costin said, "I'm sorry, you can't go." I said, "That's fair enough, I quite understand. I'm sorry there's been this mistake." And so it was, until early December. I was sent for again and told by Costin, who seemed to be somewhat aggrieved, that he'd received a direct order that I should proceed to the Transjordan Frontier Force not later than the 1st of January 1933.
Before you left Egypt, did you travel anywhere else around Egypt?
Yes, I think it was in October, the middle of October 1932, I went on what we call one of our desert trips. Now, at that time in Cairo, there were several people who were very much interested in desert trips. These involved motoring long miles, testing out equipment, and living on iron rations for several weeks at a time. Some of the officers in my regiment had already done one or two to the deep western desert south of the Siwa Oasis. Another long trip, lasting 4 weeks, had been done to southern Sudan. And another party was at that time being arranged to consist of 6 officers and 6 NCOs, with 4 Austin 7 reconnaissance vehicles we had at that time, and 2 Crossley lorries down to Luxor.
What did an Austin 7 reconnaissance vehicle look like?
Well, the ordinary Austin 7 stripped. The old Austin 7, when it came out, was seized upon by the army, or the mechanization enthusiasts in the army, as perhaps enabling them to have a very lightweight, easily maintained, inconspicuous reconnaissance vehicle. So a number of Austin 7s, standard Austin 7s, were purchased and stripped down. And in the 2 companies at the time in Cairo, being prepared for formation of the regiment, we had about 6 of those vehicles. And so it's decided to use these 6 Austin 7s, 4 Austin 7s and 2 Crossley troop carriers as a long-range mission to see exactly how the vehicles would perform, what problems of maintenance or mechanical they could give, and also to train us, the crews, on some desert navigation. And the trip selected was to go from Cairo south to Hurghada, very near the Red Sea on the coast, where there was an oil installation, and then cut across country there direct to Luxor. The party consisted of 1 captain and 5 subalterns, I think 2 sergeants, 2 corporals, and 2 private soldiers.